Hello, I'm Juliette Littman.
And I am Joe House.
Welcome to Ringer Food, the Ringer's new hub for all your food-related content. You may have known this feed as House of Carbs, and don't worry, that's not totally going away. We will be launching two new shows on the feed, and the first is Food News with me and David Jacoby. You may remember us from our days at Grantland. Well, Jacoby and I are back to go over the news, sample snacks, share some personal tales of food news, some global tales of food news. Who knows what else is to come? And House, what are you going to be doing?
Oh, my taste buds, my hungry homies, my culinary comrades, we are back. We've done it. Here to tell you that we are reigniting House of Carbs with a whole new slate of tasty episodes throughout the year. We are starting with a football fracas, a gridiron gobble fest. We're doing NFL playoff potluck featuring taste tests of the iconic food item or items of every playoff city to determine which city reigns supreme.
Ringer Food is starting up this Wednesday, January 12th. That's so soon. So be sure to subscribe on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com. This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRigger.com, and joining me on the other line, does he look like he's in Oklahoma? It's Andy Greenwald! Yeah, it's a joke from Euphoria, man. It's a show about teenagers. Maybe you should watch it. You know, maybe you should get a little bit more connected to youth culture in this country because they're the future.
It's rough. I am not connected to Euphoria, a popular television show.
Yeah.
I am not connected to Ozark, arguably more popular television show.
Who can
say? This is my fallow period. I am feeling like I'm failing the listeners of The Watch. I'm failing the larger TV diaspora. And most of all, I'm failing you, Chris.
Because no,
you, Chris, as one of the more important hosts of The Ringer's number one television podcast, the Prestige Television Podcast, you watch all this stuff.
I do. I watch it all because I love television. That's why I'm embarking on this journey. First, number one priority is
for you.
I like hanging out with Kaya. Number two is
agree.
You're my best friend. And number three, mm-hmm. I love TV. I think TV, it's capable of having fallow periods. I don't think we're in one right now, though.
I think I'm missing the boat. So talk to me about the boats before we get into all the other stuff we have on our agenda today.
Well, sure. I'll talk to you about whatever you want. I mean, like, so with Euphoria, I wanted to ask you because, like,
as a father of daughters. Oh boy.
Well, as a father of a television show, last night in Euphoria,
yeah.
Great episode. Maybe like one of my favorite episodes they've ever done.
Wow.
I'm not going to get into like spoilers or anything. First of all, do you know who Dominic Fike is? I'm really dating myself,
no.
But he plays this kid named Elliot on the show. He's already like a big musician. He has like a documentary about him up today on Hulu. And like, he's very important to lots of people, but I'm like, this dude is going to be like a huge star if he wants to be like, as far as being an actor, he's great on the show this season. They're doing this thing right now where they basically are doing these 10-minute short films at the beginning that are the cold open of Euphoria. So last night was the backstory for Cal, who's played by Eric Dane. He's one of the fathers in the show. Actually, there's not very many fathers in the show, but he is the one, and
is that the problem of Euphoria? Is it a fatherless society? Is that
there's not enough strong male role models? Yeah. In Euphoria,
what a take.
So anyway, they do this flashback short film. These are really fun. They're really good. They started the first episode had an awesome one, and this one has one. And I had to ask you this because I'm watching it last night with my wife, and I'm just like, this is good. And then we just kind of like a second later are like, yo, they've already used, it's set in the 80s. And I'm like, they've already used half of INXS's Kick album as far as like needle drops. And yeah. So I just want to run through this with you. And you tell me, because you are a man who has negotiated in some degree.
Yeah.
Like, I need to get like this song. What am I talking about here? This episode just alone had Never Let Me Down Again by Depeche Mode, Need You Tonight by INXS, The Look by Roxette, It Ain't Over Till It's Over by Lenny Kravitz, Chains of Love by Erasure, Mystify by INXS, Lips Like Sugar by Echo and the Bunnymen, She Sells Sanctuary by The Cult, a lot. A Bobby Darin song, a Selena song, a Ministry song.
Can I ask you, just sidebar, was the episode set at the seventh grade dance at my school?
It might have, let me tell you something. If this was what your seventh grade dance was like, you have a lot of chapters of your life you've neglected to share with me. It was basically about a furtive love story between two teenage boys, and then that then ends abruptly. But Andy, how does a show like manage to get half of one of the biggest albums of the 80s on its soundtrack without costing Avatar money?
Money. I mean, honestly, it's money. It if you have the budget for it, almost every song is gettable. My experience doing the picking the songs for Briar Patch was awesome, but also surprising in that there were songs that we got that I was very concerned to even mention. Like, I thought they would be very expensive. I remember in a later episode we used part of Do You Remember the First Time by Pulp, and like that feels like a really big song and a big single, and it wasn't cheap. But it was not nearly as expensive as I Have a Song to Sing, Oh, by Peter, Paul, and Mary, which nearly broke us. So it is very, first off, it can be artist driven. Like, by far the most expensive artist that we got songs from was Dolly Parton, who is apparently infamously or famously just hard drive her estate, or she's alive, but her
publishing company
drives a very, very hard bargain for those songs. Other artists are gettable. And that's often, I think, less... I think the reason Dolly Parton's songs are expensive is because Dolly Parton controls her publishing. I think songs that you think of as being expensive that aren't expensive might be because a third party controls their publishing and is just trying to maximize
value. Yeah, like Mark Cuban owns the INXS publishing and he's just like, come on in, sharks.
Just to pay the luxury tax this year. So I can't speak specifically to that. My main reaction to everything... This was true before I made a show, and it's especially true having made a show. When you tell me that something costs a lot of money, my next question is it on HBO?
Right.
And then that's usually the end of the conversation with yes. nothing but honestly, like admiration for it. You know what I mean? I guess the only other thing I'd say is HBO always, you know, supports its creators, I think. But these seem like season two flexes.
Yes. Well, also, it's pretty interesting to see, too, also, like, the first, like, five credits at the end of Euphoria. It's just like director, writer, creator, executive producer, all Sam Levinson.
Yes.
It's like, it's a very auteur driven show. I watch Euphoria. I watch a little bit of Ozark. We'll get to that at some point on this podcast, I promise. In the meantime, there's great stuff happening on the Prestige Pod about Ozark. I will say, I got knocked off my square by Ozark the first episode of season four because I was watching it, and Jonah, the son, has my same fleece that I have. And I was like, has ever happened to you where you like are looking at a television character and you're like, cuts a little close.
when it's the child?
Well, it's worse people to be than Jonah. He's very resourceful. You know, like he has built up his own money laundering database over the course of this series. So I'm really proud of him. And, you know, it's not like Patagonia fleeces are exactly like the rarest of grails. It's just most people bought one during the pandemic, I would imagine.
Well,
but
I also think that you're selling yourself short. It was already established in our conversations about Succession that you were ahead of your time as, you know, as being a layer king.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
That's
like,
true.
I think that for a long time, characters' relationship to the weather was really binary. You know, it was either hot or cold, but that's not what lived experience is like for so many of us.
Especially
and
me.
I think that this is where we're heading. You know, I think we're seeing just a greater diversity of all characters on television, particularly those who are a little bit warm when it's cold out and a little bit cold when it's hot out, right? So,
yeah, I mean, I'm currently wearing 3 layers just sitting here talking to you inside of my room. It starts at 3 and then we expand. I don't think I've ever gotten up to 6, but I would be interested in the challenge.
Well, when we lived in New York and we spent a lot of time like waiting on subway platforms and stuff in the dead of winter, was it just we didn't feel things in our bodies then because we were like either like just, you know, experiencing like we were drinking or whatever, but also that we were like just younger? Because I don't remember you. Like what I don't remember is in the dead of February, right? You walking into the Hi-Fi bar on Avenue A and suddenly turning into Michael Stipe at the MTV Video Music Awards when he wore 22 issue-based t-shirts and took them off one after another. Like, I don't remember that. I feel like you were there the night when
it was like pro-choice, like just like ripping off different t-shirts. No?
I mean, I don't think it would have been issues. You know what I mean? I feel like you would have had like June of 44 or like like a bunch of like 90s era math rock bands coming off. But do you know what I mean? Like, I don't think you weren't that guy then.
No, I think that I generally speaking in the early 2000s in New York, every single day wore a t-shirt, some kind of like, not vintage, but like thrift store shirt on top of that, a sweatshirt and a jean jacket or some kind of jacket.
That's what I remember. And then we just moved faster outside. Like we just walked faster.
Yeah, brother.
To be
we have places to go. Yeah.
Also, and here's a side question, but I'm curious about this. I never asked you this at the time, so I feel like our public podcast is a forum for it. What is the statute of limitations on when you drop the curtains on tattoos? Because I remember when you got arm tattoos, I feel like you basically then wore tank tops.
That's not true
like,
at all.
Or like you like pulled your sleeves up a lot for like a year or two, which I think I would do too.
I did, but like, why are you putting me on Front Street like that?
I'm wondering, you were youthful. You look cool.
I'm not gonna be able to get buried in a Jewish cemetery. You gotta let me have something out of the deal.
I'm not making fun of your tattoos. I guess I was wondering was like in the dead of winter, would you still be like, I will cut the arms off of this like heavy insulated armor jacket?
No. What happens is like, you go into a bar for your night long reverie, right?
Right.
And you know, back in New York, pre-Mayor Mike especially, we used to pack it in and we used to get a little smoky up in there. You know what I mean? It would get hot. It was, you know what the funny, like the craziest feeling would be walking into a bar at like 11 p.m. in New York City when it's like 30 degrees outside and your fucking glasses steam up immediately because there's so much human energy on display. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So by the time you get to like beer three or whatever you're doing, like, you might be down to a t-shirt in February. And that's when people get to see the body art.
So that's just plus.
I only have two very tasteful tattoos, I think.
They're fantastic. People don't understand. I am a fan. I am a supporter.
For them. The naked lady in a Corvette has really aged well.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's with the quote, let's drive, loser. Right?
Let me drive a little bit of this podcast. I have a bunch of things I want to talk to you about. We do have some shows we want to discuss. We were going to chat a little bit about 1883 and Vigil because we wanted to kind of pair those as the two paths TV shows, not the only two paths, but two paths TV shows can take in this day and age, and especially like what you're building for. So I have that in one bucket I want to talk.
Okay, you're driving. Chris is looking at me with such terror in his eyes right now. I did want to mention one thing, because when you mentioned early 2000s New York City bars, I have to give a shout out to, you're so worried, it's talking to me about your body art. The Meet Me in the Bathroom documentary, which premiered at Sundance, and I haven't seen it yet, but it is based on our friend Lizzie Goodman's oral history. You and I both have our names in that book, and we're proud of it.
Well, you say my name in that book, yeah.
Of course I fucking say your name. I say your name everywhere I go, all public and private spaces. But I did want to just say, like, I hope If anyone has gotten a chance to see it, message us and let us know, because they reached out when they were putting together Pulse Films. They reached out to me. This is like 2 or 3 years ago now. And they were like, do you have any archival stuff like that we could maybe mine? Because the conceit of the documentary is no talking heads. It's all like footage from the eras, era appropriate, talking you through the early 2000s rock scene in New York City. And I went in the old tape closet, and I found all my old interview tapes, and I mentioned a couple things that I had. And the only thing that they were really interested in was my long sit down with James Murphy of LCD Sound System for the seminal Spin magazine article about Brooklyn, what's happening, which featured a guy who lived in Park Slope interviewing James Murphy and Karen O, people who lived in Manhattan.
Right.
But anyway, I did find this tape, and they were like, we'd love to, you know, listen to that and send it. And I was like, oh, okay. And I spent like, and I was like, I guess I should listen to this first. And I spent fives of minutes.
Did you have to ask the Guccione estate if it was okay to like release this document?
I thought about whether I probably like texted our buddy, Steve Kandel, who was like the last editor in chief of Spin that we know about. And he was like, I'm just going to pretend you didn't ask me. So sorry, I put you on front street, Steve. I shared it with him. My only point is I felt like maybe I should listen to it before I sent it to them for this documentary, but I don't have a tape player because it was like 2018. So right. I was like, I'm sure it's fine. So I just sent it away and forgot about it. And then 3 years later, I got it back and they were like, thanks, mate. We used some of this.
You need to visit the set of Euphoria and use their tape decks.
Yes.
Yeah. So the Meet Me in the Bathroom is playing at Sundance.
Yeah, played at Sundance. You can watch it online. Know?
So this weekend I watched a phenomenal movie called Worst Person in the World. It's the new film by one of my favorite directors, Joachim von Trier. He did Reprise and Oslo. I think it's August 21st or August 21st. I can't remember the name of the second one, but he's made a bunch of films. He made Louder Than Bombs with Jesse Eisenberg a few years ago. This is part of his Oslo trilogy, and it's an excellent movie. But I was just going to mention that the Sundance Festival, you know, it's open to the public. Like you can buy a single ticket if you get the ticket in time. So I'm going to watch the Lena Dunham movie tonight.
Cool.
It's a pretty awesome experience. I don't want movie festivals to go anywhere, but it was pretty cool to be able to just like pay $20, which is like less than what I would have paid for two people to go to a movie theater anyway. And I do want to see this in a movie theater to see Worst Person at Sundance. It was a pretty cool experience.
Do you think that there's a future for that? Like, do you think that we'd be able to like attend the gala opening of something at Venice one day? Like they'll sell limited online tickets.
I think that kind of stuff, that real red carpet stuff, there's a lot of stipulations or rules with Sundance. Like if you want to attend the Q&A, you know, the live Q&A, you have to, you know, be in the room or whatever by this time. I got the tickets for the second screening of Worst Person in the World, which means there was like a 24-hour window to watch it. And once you hit play, you had 5 hours to finish it. So it created a little bit more of an event around watching it. This actually goes towards something I want to talk about anyway, but yeah, like I don't think that will work for film festivals if they want to continue to be going businesses. But I do wonder whether or not, let's say, God forbid, there is a bit of a collapse in that field of like some of the film festivals that we know and love, like Sundance or whatever, have to like reconfigure themselves entirely for a digital world or whatever. Mm-hmm. To say nothing of the supply chain of films, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know how many smaller, you know, independent dramas or independent films are going to be made that much, you know, going forward. They may need to like reach out to different audiences beyond the people who can get to Park City in January.
I think it's a good point. The thing that, while you're describing this, I'm thinking about like one of the best things to do in New York, if you're able, is to go to the U.S. Open tennis tournament. I bet you didn't think that was coming.
But I didn't think. I didn't think to go early. To like the opening rounds.
The opening rounds, because you walk around the center court stuff is the center court stuff, and you see, you know, the big stars and it's very crowded.
Like your favorite Novak Djokovic.
A dangerous thought leader that cannot be silenced. Proud of him. You walk around to all the smaller courts and you can just sit there and watch amazing tennis from the stars of tomorrow or the stars of yesterday or whatever. And it's fantastic. And I wonder if there is, I think people would bristle at this, but this idea of like a tiered film festival thing where obviously, like the new Wes Anderson movie is going to open Venice or whatever. But all the small films that are just there to be seen, I mean, I can't imagine that they wouldn't want the opportunity to also have some tickets sold and to, you know, and that's sort of how like Slam Dance started, right?
It was
like,
it's
not Sundance, but you can go to see some other movies at the same time.
But I would imagine maybe Sean would be the person to ask about this fantasy, but like I would imagine that the whole purpose of going to a Sundance or to a Telluride or to whatever is South by Southwest, especially is to create buzz and a market for your film that does not yet have a distributor. Right.
Yes.
So you go and then you're like, everybody's talking about Palm Springs or everybody's talking about this and they've sold it to Hulu or they've sold it to Amazon or they've sold it to A24 or whatever. And you know, there's a little bit of like, if anybody can go see the movie, if it's basically like these film festivals functioning as the quote unquote opening weekend for world cinema, you know, then I don't know whether or not are there so many people out there who are going to see Worst Person in the World? Although I will say word of mouth is word of mouth no matter what. So like, I'm going to tell anybody who wants to hear me talk about it that I thought Worst Person in the World was an incredible movie. I hope you see it. Like, we'll talk about it when you do, but
definitely. I guess it's also a question of who controls a final finished product, because often films are shown at film festivals and if they are then acquired, changes are made.
For sure.
And so what's the final version of it? Anyway, it's an interesting question. I've interrupted you enough. You're driving. Let's get into it.
So there was a couple of things just news-wise I thought we could get into. The biggest one was this thing I saw in Puck. So we've mentioned Matt Bellany writes for Puck. We mentioned a piece of his a couple of weeks ago. Julia Alexander wrote something that went up today that's about the objective and also anecdotal surge going on with HBO Max. Now, on Thursday, you and I discussed some hiccups that Netflix was experiencing. I think if you hold a lot of Netflix stock, you might describe it as another word besides hiccup. But Netflix came in below their projections in terms of subscriber base. I think then their stock took a hit. And you and I sort of discussed, like, where is this all going? Ozark is kind of this last, one of the last flagship shows it has, along with The Crown and Stranger Things. And I'm sure people would debate what a flagship Squid Game now is the flagship, but you get what I'm saying. So today there was this article that was basically about how HBO Max, despite everything, despite the corporate merger, the AT&T, then AT&T spinning it off to Discovery, despite some issues with the player, the actual tech in the beginning, despite some of the hostility Jason Klar experienced from Hollywood when he announced a day of release HBO Max streaming policy. Despite all that, we now get to the end of the year or the beginning of this year, and HBO Max and HBO have had a very HBO-like run of success. Now, we can get into, is it success because you and I are talking about it and like people who have podcasts and people who write for pop culture websites are talking about these shows, or are they really, really big? But I will say in this house, I'm currently watching Euphoria and Righteous Gemstones. We just got done Station 11. I love Southside, which is on HBO Max as a library offering. I love a bunch of stuff on there. And there, what was the other show that I'm watching that's on right now on HBO Max? Oh, Somebody Somewhere, the Bridget Everett show, which is really cool. So like I do think that they have this, they are definitely making shows that like I watch all the time. But it was an interesting thing to go through Julia's piece, because I thought that the thing that jumped out at me most, and I thought we could start here, she broke down a couple of like lessons you could learn from their success, was the idea of owning a couple of days of the week, which I thought was the coolest. Mm. Now, we were doing our Station 11 recap pods mostly on Thursdays, because that's when those episodes would get released. So Thursdays is when you get like new shows on HBO Max. So that would be And Just Like That, Station 11.
Hacks.
Then there's Sunday night. What was the other one you said?
Hacks.
Hacks. And then Sunday night is Gemstones, Euphoria, the usual HBO Sunday night. I would also argue that earlier last year, you had Fridays when The Matrix would come out or whatever. And you would honestly have 3 days where the eyes of the TV movie watching world would be kind of directed towards this. It's kind of an interesting new wrinkle, not even new because HBO always had Sundays, but in this world where we're like, okay, do people want to binge something? Do they want a week by week thing? This carving out little days of the week is a really interesting programming strategy.
I agree. And before I respond in full, let me say, you mentioned what we talked about last week with Netflix. I just want to do a quick correction I should have done at the top of the show. Someone pointed out to me that in our conversation last week about why Netflix is doing what it's doing and the money it spends, I named a figure for an episode of scripted television that was totally off base. I said that a scripted episode of television could cost $2.5 million. Let me just say that I have made 10 episodes of television, all of which cost more than $2.5 million. I don't know why I pulled that number out. Incorrect. Okay. Episodes of TV could cost $10, $15 million if you're making like a 30. Franchise
yeah.
show.
Yeah, right.
And if you want to play, you know, more in excess, including the Shabu Shuba album, like whatever it is, like
no,
that's,
when you get into the deep cuts, that's where the money comes.
If you listen like thieves, you better be prepared to pay for it. Okay, to your point, I thought that was really interesting too about the days of the week, because as certified old heads, we used to treasure, yeah, HBO Sunday night, NBC Thursday nights. That mattered. That sort of, you could orient your week around it, and it was something to look forward to. I candidly didn't really notice that this was happening, mainly because the streaming wars have kicked off so noisily. And it felt, especially as streamers jumped in, not only with different release strategies, like dumping it all versus three and then weekly, it felt kind of like there was no rhyme or reason to any of it. This isn't true, right? Mm-hmm. Like these streamers are carving out nights the way Disney has carved out Wednesdays for its properties. An article like this helps bring it into focus. And I think that is actually, to your point, really smart. Like not just the choosing Thursdays as a available night to choose, but also then having movies on Fridays, because we're sort of preconditioned to expect that.
Yeah.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And it goes a long way towards establishing a relationship with a brand. And I know that sounds also kind of weirdly old fashioned, if not like, you know, overly capitalistic, but one of the, I think, hurdles in this new streaming era has been, how do you take a average consumer's relationship with, say, NBC, which mm-hmm. maybe means less than it used to, but I think there are certain associations we make, whether it's Saturday Night Live or the existence of 30 Rock, the building, let alone the show, or the Law and Order franchises or whatever, and make it that, but also Peacock. You know, how do we continue this, and of what value are those connections? This begins to humanize your relationship with these services in a way that I don't think they did before, because the services just appeared to be like monolithic. The content was just constantly raining down on you. I also think that within the point you're bringing up is the other kind of interesting slug line from the article, which was somehow this thing that we thought was going to be a major problem for HBO Max, which is what's HBO and what's Max,
yeah,
might actually have worked out for them. One is that they're still leaning into this separation, and maybe it's a positive. As you said, Max Originals Thursdays, HBO Originals Sundays. That's a point of distinction that has turned into a positive, because it means they have 2 days
and
of new
HBO
content.
And HBO has selectively leaked into Mondays. I think that mm-hmm. when I last looked, I think the David Simon show, We Own the City, is going to be a Monday show. Like
they've done that.
I May Destroy You is Mondays, wasn't it?
Yeah, HBO, like every so often, they act like it's new every time they do it. But like there were a couple of years ago, they were like, oh, now we're forming a beachhead on Monday and Bored to Death is going to anchor it. Well,
right.
They gave up that beach. Shouts to Dunkirk or whatever. They didn't hold that particular sandy atoll. But, you know, they do that sometimes, and I imagine they'll continue to. But the other thing from the Puck piece that you're referencing that was interesting was the first slate of Max Originals, or just the existence of Max Originals, clearly caused enormous consternation within the building, where the people, like the hastily retired, once this stuff started to come out, president of HBO, Richard Plepler, like this was anathema to them, right? This idea, we're going to dilute the brand by not only bringing on Big Bang Theory and Friends, but also just having different originals spearheaded by a different creative team. That creative team is now gone. Casey Bloys has consolidated it. But some of the stuff that predated his takeover of the creative reins clearly has paid big dividends, right? As evidenced in this article, which is that HBO, you know, was the crown jewel box of TV, but really lagged in certain sectors of the audience that maybe didn't matter as much when it was about adding to your cable bill, but definitely mattered when it came to attracting and keeping subscribers to a large service. And in the Julie Alexander piece, she talks about how, particularly with women, there was a deficit of viewers.
Yeah. And then you offer up Sex Lives of College Girls, Flight Attendant, and just like that, and Gossip Girl, that is that. I mean, she makes the point. It's something that HBO wasn't offering, you know, and that's kind of where we were talking about with Netflix, where it's like, I don't really know. Like, I was like, you know, is Netflix ever going to do the prestige water cooler drama anymore? They do it in movies, but it seems like in TV, they've seemed to have lost interest in that kind of show, the morning show type, like flashy, like we got this person on, the, you know, and HBO actually has sought out to make of like a kind of more diverse offering of what they can do while still somehow kind of like generally speaking, high quality.
A lot of things that they did that were really got a lot of head scratching have worked out, including Jason Kilar's decision last year to just a year and a half ago now to put all movies on HBO Max. It worked. I mean, is Christopher Nolan ever going to forgive him? No. But one thing we learned from this article is just last year, HBO and HBO Max had 38 million subscribers between them. This year, they have 74 million. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a pretty significant increase. And to your point, like, it's one thing to be a company where you're like, well, we just have the best of the best. So we know everyone else is doing big genre entertainment, but we do Game of Thrones, which is the HBO version of that, which in their minds is the best possible version, or the one that, you know, people who didn't read Tolkien will like this. But if you're doing a larger service where the goal is to keep people paying and keep them in your ecosystem, it doesn't make sense for when the viewer finishes Game of Thrones, you need those boxes on the bottom of the screen saying, finish that, you might like this. And so doing this corporate merger stuff that maybe feels tacky to talk about if you're used to the old HBO, now they have like six DC properties they can tell you to watch. You know what I mean? And like that, it didn't used to be organized that way, and it's clearly working. It's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting.
In her piece, Julia recounts this sort of exchange that Plepler and John Stankey had when I think they were doing kind of either a town hall or some sort of press conference. And Stankey, who was, you know, was in charge of AT&T, and Plepler was in charge of HBO. And they had this exchange where they were talking about, do you want to own hours of the week or days of the week? You know, mm-hmm. like, and it was essentially that was going to be the pivot that HBO was going to have to make to scale up and start taking more and more hours of the week for their audience. And Stankey said, basically, because it's, you know, still down at the end of the day, it's about making money. And Plepler actually said, well, we do make money. And Stankey said, not enough. And I think not enough is kind of driving all of the anxiety around the creative arts right now, and or at least pop culture arts. Like, I had this feeling when I was watching the Sundance movie that I watched. I watched this Asghar Farhadi movie on Friday, this called The Hero.
Awesome, that's
movie.
On Prime, right?
Yeah. And I watched both of these films, and I don't know anything about the...
Love to watch my auteurist Iranian films on Amazon.
But I don't know anything about the economics of A Hero or Worst Person of the World.
Right.
But it was interesting to watch these films and juxtapose them with the recent round of especially awards time promo that's been going on for a lot of like the biggest Hollywood names. So I listened to Bradley Cooper. He was on The Business with Kim Masters. And he was like, I have to think of like a different way to make money outside of movies, because like the kind of movies that I like to make are disappearing. And Ben Affleck said the same thing. He's like, I don't think I'll ever have another movie open theatrically because I'm not going to be Batman anymore. And I don't want to do those kinds of movies. And there's this kind of like, I'm walking out here. I got my palms out. I'm like, what the fuck is happening to the thing that I love? And I'm like, can you guys just do this, but just not expect that much money for it? Because... nobody is telling Asghar Farhadi or Joachim von Trier that like, well, there's no Batman in your movie, so we're not going to fund it. Somehow they're getting these movies funded. They just may not make a huge amount of money doing it.
Yeah. I mean, that is a reckoning that's come to anyone who's worked in any aspect of the media over the last 10, 20 years. There used to be one way of doing it and one level of expectation of what you would receive for it. And then that's changed. And it seems weird, or actually that's the American workforce in general, right? But it's weird to apply it to like, I used to make $20 million a movie, Affleck. Like that's sure. a weird lens with which to consider the declining value of the American worker, but it's 100% part of it. Yeah, I
understand that there is like the labor aspect of it and the like how we value work has been completely fucked over. But there is also the part that, like, independent movies, when we were growing up, like, it wasn't uncommon to go see a movie at the Ritz or something. And it was like, this was made by a person maxing out a credit card, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. And it felt fresh and alive and exciting. And maybe it would go to Sundance and maybe that filmmaker would get a budget the next time. And I understand that that middle ground has disappeared. But sometimes I'm like, I don't know. I mean, Bradley Cooper could probably make like a cool small movie if you wanted to.
Yeah, I think anybody, I mean, there's especially with artists like that, I genuinely don't want to ascribe bad faith motives to them. And I think that they have a right, even just on a purely ego level, to be like, it was cool to be able to make a passion project and then go to the Chinese theater and have a premiere for it,
mm-hmm.
and know that the eyes of the world would be on it, even if they then turned away because they didn't like it. Like, I get that. That's a very paradigm shifting reckoning to go through, and they'll probably feel some sadness or loss at that. It is a strange hallmark of this moment that it's never been practically simpler to create something, to create content, right? Like, you could, I remember a couple of years ago when Sean Baker made Tangerine, and they were like, this was made using a phone. And we were like, what the f-? And now everything could be made using a phone.
Soderbergh went through that whole thing where he was like, I'm going to make movies on phones and break the distribution model. And like, Logan Lucky will like change movies forever.
Every day I pick up from my charging pad a filmmaking device more powerful than David Lean could ever dream of. And I use it to play Wordle. You know what I mean? Like, so let's remember that
thank
we could
God David
all be
Lean
making,
didn't have Wordle. Yeah.
Kind of. Well, Lawrence of Arabia would have been shorter, probably. You could, the making it isn't the issue. The thing that no one really understands, this goes back to what we were kind of just sort of, you know, we were just lightly rallying about the future of film festivals, a topic with which I'm completely unqualified to opine on, but it's the distribution and the idea or expectation of an audience. That's the thing that people haven't quite figured out. It just keeps movies. Actually, it's what's weird is from, and maybe this is the wrong perspective to bring to it, because this is, I am not as embedded in cinematic culture as someone like Sean is, who's not just, you know, watching all the movies, but also talking to the filmmakers and their concerns.
Sean,
and paying more attention
actually,
to
it's a little known fact about him, now only sits in director's chairs. Like when we go to bars and stuff, he's like, I actually have to go back to my car and get this director's chair.
I mean, he's taller in them, which I think, you know, he allows him to kind of, the image of Sean bringing his own seat to the bar has undone me. Oh no, I remember what I was going to say. Movies seem really valuable to me in a way, not just because of, but it's just not the same way. Meaning Warner Brothers theatrical slate, probably long-term of the last year and a half, more return on investment than their theatrical slate for the previous 10 years. Can we see the proof of that? No, their books are opaque. We don't actually know that. But they would release a lot of movies in the old days, meaning like pre-2016, and a lot of them would bomb, and they would lose a lot of money on most of them and make a lot of money on a very few of them. All of these movies were actually, this was the most coherent theatrical strategy in the last decade of movie making, probably, right? Like, other than when Disney was like, no, we're just going to let Kevin Feige tell us when something's coming out. Oh, that worked out real well, too.
I thought you were going to say, like, when Disney was like, we're just going to pull Lion King off the shelves every year.
That was Chapek, right?
No, that was like always the Disney thing is like, make sure you buy Cinderella for $80 before they take it out. Like,
I thought we figured out that like young Chapek was the guy like sitting on all the VHS cases for the Jungle Book being like, I control this. But that was your other tattoo. People don't realize this. It was a young, you still had hair then, Chapek sitting on a giant throne made of the Aristocats VHS tapes. And I always appreciated the artistry of it. Anyway, this worked for them in terms of like doubling the subscribers of their whatever. Similarly, Netflix just having movies. I don't know what Netflix is opaque, but in another way, they're totally transparent, right? Because if they're still doing it, it's working. They have no sentimentality.
Yeah.
It's not like they don't give shows we got along so well, you can have a final season. They don't do that. So them having these indie movies and having just a bunch of them every month, that's really clearly working for them. And if you are making a movie in a certain budget window, you can get bought by a Netflix or an Apple or a Prime, and You're doing okay.
I guess the tough thing is like that is it though. There is no real alternative. There's not a really thriving independent theatrical experience throughout the country, at least not to my knowledge. And I don't know that, like, you know, I mean, I think, you know, somebody who would probably be able to speak to this really well is Mark Duplass, like somebody who has kind of come through this and is now doing work with some of the streamers. I don't know. Maybe we'll have him on and talk to him about it. I'm very curious about it. Something about watching these movies this weekend, I was just like, are we sure movies are dying? Like, maybe we...
I think Mark would be a great person to talk about because he also has some perspective on what happened with music, because he was also a musician in an indie band. And I think maybe that's why I'm a little bit less exercised about it, because we saw this happen with music where we were like, oh, this doesn't run the monoculture anymore. This doesn't matter anymore, but now there's more of it and we can get it. There's a poster, big poster on Sunset for the other Benedict Cumberbatch movie of the holiday
season.
Electrical Life of Louis Wayne, which he talked a lot about in his Marc Maron episode. Sounds pretty good. I think I'll probably will check it out. But
that was a little bit of a pugnacious, little spicy episode, didn't you think?
Yes, it was. Yeah, Mark had some issues with Power of the Dog. He wanted to push back.
Yeah, but
right?
He was also just like, see, I think that there's just like this really funny thing right now because he's got such a run of amazing actors on.
Yeah.
Where he's just like, yeah, you know, I do a bit of acting, you know. Like,
oh, well, if you want to talk about this, I mean.
But where are we going? Go ahead. Talking about
Electrical Lives. Like both of us, you know, became translucent and levitated above the earth when we heard Javier Bardem be like, so you like actors so much? This is why I'm here. And Maron's like, I actually won an acting award in Spain. You know that festival? And he's like, yes, of course. It's a beautiful festival.
And Bardem's like, are we recording yet?
it's amazing.
And then he just talks about AC/DC for like 45
minutes.
And
they become friends. That's why he's the best. I loved it. But the only reason I brought up the Cumberbatch movie was, what is that movie? Meaning, into whom does that matter? Like, I think by a unemotional metric, that movie is already a success. Because Amazon bought it and it is available to watch in millions of households around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So by a financial standpoint, I would say it's probably a success. It's probably at least broken even, or its investors have made some money on top of it. From a zeitgeist perspective, or the way that we also consider the success of movies, does it exist? Do you know what I mean? Like that, and that's, I think, where a lot of these things, that's kind of the uncanny valley where a lot of these things fall. People making something is always significant and challenging and worthy of celebration.
You hit on it though. There's like something about the physical experience of this that I think we've probably, at least you and I have probably deprived ourselves of, or the, you know, we live in a city that has been, it was hit hard by COVID, but it's also like, you know, the movie theaters have closed. Mm-hmm. I think it's been a really tumultuous couple of years in the town where you would expect the movie business to be thriving no matter what. And I had this experience when I went and saw Licorice Pizza out in Westwood, where I was like, the line was like down the block, and there was also a pinball parlor that they had opened up next to it to like sort of be as like an additional experience to the movie. And I was like, this is like fucking 2001 coming out in the late 60s. You know what I mean? I hadn't been around like a real surge of humanity around a movie other than like a couple of screenings over the year. And there's a really different vibe when you're out there with like the people who are paying to go to the movie. It feels completely different than it does when it's like, oh yeah, Matrix came out and it's on HBO Max.
This still matters to us. And I think to people who are plugged into the value of that experience, I talked about it, you know, in passing on the mic before, but like Christmas week was just bookended for me by like two of the most ideal theater going experiences I could ever imagine. One was seeing Spider-Man, which I loved, and it was just joyous to watch the movie, but made especially fun by how excited everyone was, including the people who were definitely too young to be doing this, but just kept shouting, "Where's Toby?" I had no idea that, you know, Maguire fans really repped like that. And then the back end of it was going to see at the Lemley in Glendale, I saw Drive My Car, which was, I think, the best movie of the year. And just another thing that is not, you can't recreate it, that experience, partly because I would rather see a 3-hour plus foreign language film in a theater with a closed door where I am focused and enveloped and enraptured by it. Like, I am appreciating it more. There's no question. that's the great thing about the theatrical experience. But I think that sometimes we've been finding ourselves talking around an issue like this because it's very hard to put your arms around what is missing and what is different. Because here, let me put it in the form of a concrete question. Like, there is a dimension where Nightmare Alley exists.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? What I mean is Oscar award-winning filmmaker Guillermo del Toro made a movie with Bradley Cooper, with a lot of big stars. Rooney Mara is in it, right? Isn't Cate Blanchett in it as well?
Cate Blanchett's in it, yeah.
It would like to be nominated for Oscars. I have no evidence that this movie exists other right. than for the people to whom that they already care about. Like, there are people in LA who are like, oh my God, we have to go to the theater to see the black and white cut of Nightmare Alley. I believe this movie is being released nationally in March, right? Like, it's totally, you could tell me it's all a put on.
Right.
And I don't mean to discredit the movie. It might be good. I just mean, this is just such a weird thing to be talking about because in the scheme of things, the movie exists. It will continue to exist. People will find it. It will be judged by history or by people who have enjoyed it or not enjoyed it. But we're still cramming this into a not just outdated, but now almost completely irrelevant machine of hype.
Yeah, and I also don't know whether or not people who are much younger than us care about this conversation at all. You know what I mean? Like, I doubt that they're listening to the podcast anyway, but like, I can't tell whether or not, like, where is Nightmare Alley is something that's like really driving a lot of like anxiety or stress among 22-year-olds. Maybe they are if they're in film school, you know what I mean? But it was something that was there and now it's not there, and like, life goes on.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Let's talk a little bit about TV before we go. Sure. I hope our listeners enjoyed 45 minutes pinging around before we got to TV. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit about 1883 and Vigil, because those are two of the shows I've enjoyed most watching this year. 1883 obviously started about 6 weeks ago. Vigil dropped around Christmas on Peacock. It had been out in England before that. Vigil, 6 episodes, really tight. Military thriller starring Saran Jones and Rose Leslie as detectives investigating a murder on a British nuclear submarine. So there's that
and
show.
Stannis Baratheon, by the way.
I mean, there's a lot of hitters in this show. And then 1883 is essentially Paramount's Dave Kingman home run swing at launching like a blockbuster sweeping epic that could be like a modern version of Wagon Train or a modern version of Lonesome Dove, whatever, however you want to put it. It's a huge sweeping Western starring Sam Elliott, Tim McGraw, and Faith Hill. One is built for the longest of long runs. I could see 1883 going up to 1890 if they wanted. And one is a middleweight puncher that's just doing exactly what it says it's going to do when it walks in the ring, which is a bunch of jabs and then knock you out with a finale. I thought Vigil was awesome. I'm not trying to say Vigil is like this transcendent drama or anything like that. It's really, really good. 1883, I'm curious what your thoughts on, you know, you watched the first one. I'm keeping up with it. You know, it's very Taylor, but it's also like, I think, quite beautiful to watch and also like a real interesting spin on a story that we've seen before. This sort of like the wagon trains moving west frontiersman discovery story. So where do you want to start with these two?
Well, I think what I want to start with is just what unites them. We were talking last week about how jazzed we were for FX to bring back Justified, just because we, you know, there's a type of TV show and a type of pleasure neuron hitting televised experience that we haven't felt has been serviced as much. And it's great to be doing that. And I, for me, watching Vigil and 1883 together was a reminder that TV is still TV. And, you know, you mentioned home run swings. Not every show, that's not just that not every show can be I May Destroy You or Station 11 or something like that. Not every show should try to be. This is not what the business is. The large majority of TV viewers would like something that is well-made, well-crafted, a little bit better than it ought to be, but again, servicing pleasure neurons that already exist, basically, mm-hmm. not forging new paths. And Vigil particularly, they're really good at this in the UK. You know,
yeah. You mean Brits? Yeah.
It is. I joked before that the show was like Chris Ryan Mad Libs, you know, police procedural, murder investigation, Scotland, nuclear submarine. But all the UK procedurals are kind of like that. They are, by and large, better, I think, than what like broadcast procedurals in America. But so what to watch Vigil, though, is to be like, yeah, all right, well, okay, of course. Well, mm-hmm. that seems like a busy week in the nuclear submarine industry, but okay, I'll allow it.
Yeah.
You know, you have to buy in. And then when you buy in, you're rewarded for it. It's very diverting. It's really entertaining. It's really well made. I was perusing some of the response that it got in the UK where it was a huge ratings hit at the end of the summer. And my favorite review was just like, this fucking show gets the internal dimensions of a submarine all wrong. It's like, can you imagine that? I'm like, I would hope they built a set with taller ceilings, you know?
Like, there's this amazing thing where in the first episode of Vigil, I feel like they really did a good job and were very careful to be like, it's very claustrophobic, yes. tight quarters. And then like by episode three, they're like, this is a, like let's be real. We're not going to make these people like bang into walls for 6 hours.
Or it's like anytime they go up and down submarine steps, it's the same steps. Like, why would they build more steps? You know, I don't understand why you would get mad about that. So I like the show. I'm going to keep watching it. It's, you know, you could be like, boy, this seems implausible that this police detective with recent massive familial trauma involving both water and confined spaces should be put on a submarine.
Yes. That I meant.
Or you're like,
I alluded to that. Yeah.
Yeah. Or you could just be like, well, what a week. You know what I mean? Like, I guess when it rains, it pours.
What did you think of Rose Leslie as detective superintendent or detective investigator, Kirsten Longacre?
I think I don't know if there's a way to say this without sounding like a middle-aged creep, but I just mean this profoundly when I feel like we would have had posters of this detective inspector on our college dorm room walls, because she represents everything that was appealing to us about the wider world. Like, she's
Scottish.
She's tough AF. Yeah. She's Scottish. And yeah, she's awesome. She's awesome. And also that's the other thing that I really appreciate, not just about UK TV, but about this current moment of TV, especially with limited series, which is just like Rose Leslie has been on. She's been in one kind of costume drama in Downton Abbey. She's been on another kind of costume drama in Game of Thrones. But you could tell that she's pretty thrilled to just use her native Glaswegian accent and just wear, like, you know, button down shirts and browbeat people. Like, it just seems cool. And it's fun to see actors be able to flex the muscles they want to flex. The 1883 thing, and I apologize if I am coming at both these shows from kind of like a meta industry.
No, that's fine.
Macro perspective. Because I feel confident saying 1883 is not for me.
Right.
But the two things that I found most interesting about it were, one, that the marriage of Taylor Sheridan and the larger Paramount CBS Viacom Corporation is so perfect. It is the shows that he makes. I mean, we talked about this briefly with Mayor of Kingstown, but like, these are classed up CBS shows. And I mean that with affection. You know what I mean? Like, there's... In 1883,
I think 1883 kind of transcends that, but I hear what you're saying.
I think that it can with its ambition, and it's certainly like the way that it's shot. It looks beautiful. It's beautifully lit, and like it. No, I don't mean it to tear it down. I just mean that like every character as introduced in 1883 is like, "Hello, I'm exactly what you think I am."
Sure,
and enjoy it. You know what I mean? Like it's cool. There's not a single moment of surprise in terms of like, oh, he's the tough lawman.
See, that's the thing.
I
agree with you. It's like when Sam Elliott shows up, it's not
weeping
like he is
corpses?
Not a vaudevillian actor. You're like, oh, yes, it is right. A ex-military guy who's lost someone and is trying to look for a purpose in life. It's exactly who I thought Sam Elliott was going to be. But within the context of the story itself,
right.
The thing that I find so exciting about Taylor's stuff is that anything can happen. And it's not anything can happen in terms of like, big twist, this guy dies. It's anything can happen in terms of the scenarios that play out within any given episode, movie, whatever, actually feel alive in a very palpable way. Like where you're like, oh my God, like this is, they've been attacked already, or they've decided to leave this person, or they've decided that this is how it's like the decision making and the plot points don't feel as familiar as the material should, given the fact that it's a wagon train show.
Can I speak to why I think that is? I think, and this remains the most interesting point to me about all of it, which is we have never seen auteur television like this. And I don't mean in terms of like someone with a very specific vision. I mean, there are only two people who can make shows entirely alone and then they will be aired by a major corporation at this point.
Taylor Sheridan.
What's that?
Sam Levinson.
Taylor Sheridan and Tyler Perry.
Right.
They are on their own islands and they can do what they want and the networks will air them. And watching 1883, for me, the thing that felt most surprising and often jarring was that there are no notes and there's no one else in the room. And you can tell for good or for ill. For me, often it was a little bit for ill. Like in the pilot, when we meet Tim McGraw and he's single-handedly guns down like a bunch of bandits, visually, I found it a little incoherent that he's being pursued by six people who are shooting guns nonstop. And then he stops, gets off of his horse and guns them all down.
I was like, watch more westerns.
That seems unlikely. But also it was just like, well, he directed it and it made sense to him. And no one was like, Taylor, where are the sight lines? It doesn't matter. It made sense for the story. Similarly, like there's just some like when he picks up his Tim McGraw picks up his family at the train station and he gets them on a very scenic. He takes the scenic route through town where there's a bunch of fist fights and assaults. The camera lovingly shows the wagon stopping. Then it cuts to them getting out of the wagon. Then it cuts to them going into the hotel. Then it cuts to them going upstairs and then turning a corner. I'm like,
you get a sense of like, okay, it's on the second floor. I got it.
Yeah. I was like, that's cool. So I could retrace my steps to their room. Like there was no one being like, Taylor, we get that they made it to the hotel. You could show them.
I'm making a joke about it, but
I'm very sincere that you rarely get to see something. And I'm sure that there are many, there are good things. I brought up some funny examples and I apologize. It was disrespectful because this dude
You don't have to apologize.
What I mean is,
I actually think that there's a reason for that specific thing. The sight lines and the wagon train fight or the wagon fight, I'd have to go back and look at it. But big sight line guy, I know. But one of the things I really like about this show is how it is stressing that the major things that would have been facing these people were you living back in the 19th century and going from Texas to Oregon or wherever they're going, or Montana, I guess, eventually, because it's a Yellowstone thing, is disease, the land itself, you know, and just like the actual like natural deterrence that would be existing there, aside from bandits and whatever else. I often think about like how incomprehensible it is to like, what people must have done, like when they were just like, we're essentially going to fucking walk from Texas to Montana to find a house. Like you and I could like be like, I don't want to be here there, but like we could go to Dubai tonight. You know what I mean? Like, if you want to go to Dubai,
are you asking?
You got to tell me, okay?
Are you asking? Let's go.
The fact that they're like, they get off the thing, they go up the steps, they go into the saloon, they go up the stairs, they go into the room. I think it creates this, like, this whole thing was very arduous. Like, if there was no elevators, there was no...
I appreciate that.
Valets, there was no anything. Like, it's like every...
he does one up. I mean, I got a lot of this from... It's a similar reason why I loved Lonesome Dove, which we talked about at length last year, which tracks a similar journey.
For 200 pages or whatever,
Also, as we learned, I think we talked about this in our podcast, that, you know, Larry McMurtry wrote Lonesome Dove and then was like, oh, right, I forgot about trains. Like, he forgot trains existed. And so I felt like there was a little bit of a subtweet at Larry that so much of 1883 where the guys are like, we don't want to go and then like go on this journey with you, Sam Elliott, and then have to like spend the winter in Oregon. He's like, I'll send you back on the train.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, cool. Okay. I did have one. The one that I did want to pick was for people who haven't watched 1883, Sam Elliott's character has been hired to lead a journey of immigrants,
German immigrants, basically, yeah,
of right. German immigrants who would like to settle. And he, when he meets them in the 1883 pilot, he gives them a really hard time.
Yeah.
Really hard time. They've overpacked. They don't know about guns or poison ivy or anything. They
He's
don't
like
speak
Herb
English.
Brooks with the 1980 U.S. hockey team. Yeah.
I have to say, Chris, these immigrants have already traveled over 5,000 miles to get to Fort Worth, Texas. I just feel like they deserved a little more respect. You know what I mean? That is so far. Do you understand? Like, they brought all that luggage from yeah. fucking your... I Googled Bavaria to Fort Worth, okay? It is 5,172 miles where they brought their armoires
yeah.
and their whatever. And then this one dude is like, you are dirt. You know nothing of what we do here. Show some respect. I mean, that's far.
So you
I get that the last few miles are tough.
You feel like he didn't have a robust enough customer service policy.
I feel like he yada yada'd the Atlantic fucking ocean. That wasn't easy to cross either.
I feel
either.
Like dudes who fought in the Civil War kind of like, they started at that. And then, you know.
It's true. Also, and I this might be a small spoiler, but like there is a thing in the pilot where he's just like, not a single one of you Germans speak a word of English. And they're all like nine. And then the one guy has some like little bit of smallpox on his back.
Yeah.
And he's like, please, this is fine. This is nothing. I promise you. I will go with you to Oregon. It's nothing. It's a rash. All of a sudden, he gets real fluent. And I think that that actually is how the human mind works.
Oh, that you could just like learn to speak English when you realize you're in danger?
If a dude has just told me, go find a nearby river, lie down next to it, and die quietly, I could speak fucking Sanskrit. Do you know what I mean? Like, I
kind of want you to just keep watching just for the challenge. I obviously love it, but like I almost want to. So I would also say that, like Yellowstone, 1883's pilot is the most deliberative, I guess, or slow paced element of it. Like once they get out of town, and now that the wagon train is moving, I find it to be quite propulsive.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's not propulsive. I mean, stuff happens. You know.
Yeah.
It starts with something happening that we're going to get to later, I guess.
We could talk about it. I'm sure people are either checking it out, but like I wouldn't mind checking back in on it. I'm glad you liked Vigil, and I'm glad you watched these.
I like Vigil. I guess the thing that I wanted to say was I don't think it's unlike many people here in this Nightmare Alley loving town of Hollywood, California. I am not perplexed by the popularity of the Taylor Sheridan shows. Like it is not surprising to me. I'm not watching it like trying to crack a code. Like there was nothing in the 1883 pilot that made me think, well, how is this connecting with America?
Oh my God.
You know,
it's incredible.
It's a bizarre act of probably, I guess, ego-driven navel gazing to be like, if only we could understand why heroes in the Old West played by the biggest country music stars of their generation.
And Sam Elliott.
With guns and horses. Like, what's the problem here? Of course it's successful. Good on them.
You did it, man. You came through today. I want to say thank you to Kaya McMullen, but I really want to say thank you to Andy Greenwald.
Wow.
When he's counted out, that's when he's strongest.
Who counted me out?
I don't know. I think you counted yourself out. I think you need to go look yourself in the mirror and you'd be like, don't doubt me again.
You know what this was like? This
and then
was...
you got to check yourself for smallpox because I'm leaving you behind if you ever do this to me again.
Last night when yesterday afternoon we were texting when it looked like Tom Brady was going to win the game, and we were texting back and forth about future podcasts. It was a little bit like when the other Pinkerton dude comes up to Sam Elliott sitting in a field holding a gun to his head. And he's basically like, I see what you're doing. I respect it. But if you're going to do it quickly, because I don't want to dig a hole at nighttime. That's what you were like to me on the texts about today's podcast. And you know,
I motivated you properly.
We saddled up.
Thanks, Kaya. Thanks to Andy. We will be back on Thursday. Thanks for listening to The Watch.
We'll dig another hole then.